Proposed Tacloban Recovery and Rehabilitation Plan, March 2014. Drafted by the Tacloban City Government in partnership with UN Habitat. Vision: Tacloban City. Resilient, vibrant, livable. Resilient.
We will have the capacity to bounce back from disaster impacts.
We will be able to manage the unavoidable, for example, typhoons.
We will be able to accommodate and adapt to new development demands.
Vibrant.
We will have a bustling economy.
We will be attractive to tourists and investors.
Livable.
We will be living in peaceful, safe, and sustainable environment.
We will have access to prime social services.
We will have continued jobs and livelihood opportunities.
We will sustain our transparent and accountable governance system that listens and works with all of the city's constituencies.
Tacloban City, resilient, vibrant, livable.
Resilient, vibrant, livable. What has become of this vision in the decades since Haiyan? From Princeton University's Blue Lab, this is Carried by Water. I'm Mario Soriano. This episode, we'll hear from city officials, researchers, NGOs, and residents of resettlement areas to learn about the experience of relocating Haiyan survivors to their new homes in the long process of disaster recovery. We'll hear about the Tacloban government's strategy of retreating from coastal hazards by moving displaced people several kilometers north of the city center and the resulting loss of livelihood and access to critical services. We'll hear from survivors about everyday challenges in the resettlement sites, including unreliable access to a steady supply of clean water. We'll also hear about one ambitious project that attempted to present an alternative, people-driven version of the resettlement process in the current realities of the community there. Episode 4: Away from the Hazards. Part 1: Allure and Alarm of Coastal Living. We're in the MV Eva Jocelyn Shrine in the Anibong district of Tacloban. This is one of a handful of memorials in Leyte and Samar dedicated to preserving the memory of Typhoon Yolanda. The inscription reads, quote, MV Eva Jocelyn is one of the 8 marine vessels pushed inland here in Barangay Anibong by a giant 6-meter-high storm surge caused by the 375-kilometer-per-hour winds of Super Typhoon Yolanda. International name, Haiyan. Yolanda is the deadliest typhoon ever recorded in Philippine modern history and the strongest to make landfall on Philippine soil. Unveiled on November 7, 2015, 2 years to the eve of Typhoon Yolanda's devastation of Tacloban City. End quote. The ship memorial is right next to the road, hence the constant whir of vehicles. In the summer of 2023, another type of sound permeated the air. Clanging of metal against nails, roof sheets, tile, wood, concrete. These were the sounds at the tail end of the mandatory demolition of residential structures within the designated no-build zone. For years, people have been pushed away from and pulled back towards life along the coasts. The government has been engaged in a protracted process of relocating coastal villagers to resettlement communities further inland, in an area known as Tacloban North, about 15 kilometers north of downtown Tacloban. Here in Anibong, we met a street cleaner named Dexter. He is one of the thousands of survivors relocated to Tacloban North. He moved back to the coast, here in Anibong, after finding life in the inland resettlement area unbearable. He told us that his father suffered a stroke and died there because of the heat. Dexter said he thinks the resettlement area is cursed.
People there, they become weak because there is no sea. The sea is far. It's not good for the body. Here, life is good, with the sea breeze blowing just like this. You can just stay out here. It's nice.
He tells us that life on the coast offers all that one could need.
Life is good here, even if you have very little. If you have nothing to eat, you can go catch fish. If you catch a lot, you can sell it in the market downtown. You can get there just by walking. Even if life is difficult, you can manage as long as you're here. There in the resettlement areas, it's more difficult. It's far. You can't get downtown if you don't have the money to pay for transportation. Here, you just walk.
The local government says the time has come to finally move on, away from the coast. Their mantra is that people like Dexter should accept the reality that living by the sea is no longer tenable. It's time to retreat inland. Brando Bernadas of the Tacloban City Disaster Risk Reduction and Management Office.
There are still people who would still insist that it is still safe to reside along coastal area, considering that their everyday living is within the city. That is one of the ironies of building permanent shelter for rehabilitation and resettlement after people were awarded with permanent houses for free. They still insist to live their lives along the coastal area. That now, we are now imposing mandatory and forced demolition of all residences with corresponding resettlement already in the north. And you have seen this probably already along Anibong, towards the shipwreck, and now we are starting, beside the fish port, we are starting demolition by next week.
The primary consideration is to move people far away from the coastal hazards, as identified by the government.
Any structure that are found in danger zones, these are structures that are to be demolished, especially if the land is owned by the national government or the city government for that matter. Those people who were already awarded with houses and insist on living still in the coastal area, these are the ones subject for administrative and forced demolition. We cannot allow them to stay. We want as much as possible, we do not anymore evacuate people from the coastal areas, because these are families, structures that are immediately impacted when a hydromet hazard might as well impact Tacloban City.
We also spoke to Ted Jobson from the Tacloban City Housing and Community Development Office.
I used to be the executive assistant, and then we created the City Housing and Community Development Office to really provide housing needs for the people of Tacloban, especially for the informal settlers or squatters, as we call it here, especially for those families living in the danger zone. What are the danger zone? Coastal areas, landslide-prone areas, and flood-prone areas. And if there's a government projects like highways, bridges, opening up roads, we have to also provide houses. But now, because of Yolanda, the main purpose of this housing is for the Yolanda victims. No other purpose, but really provide for Yolanda victims.
Ted told us how Tacloban North started to take shape.
After Yolanda, Mayor Alfred Romualdez asked me if we have a government property. We have about 86 hectares property in the north with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, Mines and Geoscience. We have an assessment that the area is free from flooding, free from landslide. And PhilBox also gave an assessment that there is no active fault line.
PhilBox is the Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology.
And of course, it's far from the coastal area. So those are the considerations. That's why we decided to have our relocation site in Tacloban North. That's about 15 kilometers from the city. It's a big area, it's an open area, and it's like a cluster that we're doing now. It's not one big area with housing projects. There's a housing project here, and then there's an open space, a farmhouse, a farming area. So it's, you know, clustered in the north.
People who lost their homes to Yolanda first stayed in donated tents and in evacuation centers that were still standing. Tacloban's relocation plan for them involved two phases. In the first phase, displaced people were to move out of these tents and evacuation centers into temporary or transitional shelters that were prepared in both the downtown area and in the north. These transitional shelters were typically prefabricated wooden bunkhouses or the traditional nipa or palm tree huts. The second phase of the resettlement would involve relocating all families in the transitional shelters to permanent housing units in Tacloban North. Development of Tacloban North involved multiple actors, including the national and local government, private donors, and non-government organizations. The area will accommodate a substantial portion of Tacloban's population.
Yolanda housing projects is really free, 100%. You don't have to pay. We are also thankful not only with the National Housing Authority, but with the NGOs like Habitat for Humanities, Lions International, UNDP, PICE, GMA Capuso, one big media network here in the Philippines. So that's about 3,000 houses. We're talking about 17,000 plus families. 70% were already relocated in the north. 17,000 plus the existing villages or barangays in the north. So basically, I'm talking about 20,000 families.
We ask him about the ongoing demolition of houses along coastal areas.
So it's been 10 years. It will be 10 years this coming November 8th. We're still doing the demolition of houses in the coastal area, ongoing, because they did not transfer the house there in the north. And as far as the city is concerned, as far as the NGOs are concerned, they have signed an agreement that if they have already the houses, they have to move away from the hazard zone. When we do a demolition, other agencies are involved. We have the Commission on Human Rights, Presidential Commission for the Urban Poor, Department of Social Welfare and Development, and we have our city engineers. We provide transportation for the transfer. We give notices. We provide manpower. We provide the logistics. As far as we are concerned, we will not demolish a house if they have no units to transfer.
He says it probably would have been a better idea to try to find a relocation site closer to the city for all the displaced populations.
I think if I'm going to turn back the time, I'd rather have my housing projects within the city, not that far, because if you're going to put it farther, let's say in the north, you have to spend a lot of money to provide the utilities. You have to open up roads. You have to have school buildings, health centers. Whereas if you're going to just put it within the city where it's far from the coastal area, yeah, it's quite expensive, the land, but you are able to provide all the basic services right away because it's just within the area. Like when we talk about livelihood, they can easily commute. When you talk about schools, when you talk about the market, where they can go, it's just within the proximity.
Who are the people being relocated to Tacloban North? Majority of them are the urban poor. They have built homes made of light materials along coastal areas for decades. Many of them depended on the sea for food and livelihood as fisherfolk, and the easy access to downtown Tacloban allowed them to find miscellaneous opportunities for employment and services. In moving these populations to the north to retreat from the physical hazards of the coast, are they inadvertently being exposed to other forms of social and economic risk? Part 2. Poverty, Politics, and Disaster Futures. Algina Lacaba and her family were resettled from a coastal barangay to the GMA Capuso village in Tacloban North. We heard her story of surviving Haiyan's storm surge back in episode 2. She told us that some of her neighbors there in the north still return to the coast for livelihood.
Sa ngayon kasi bumabalik na yung iba doon sa
Now, there are some who are returning to the coastal areas. Not that they live there, but they just go there to find livelihood. That's what people are doing now. They go back and forth. The head of the family, the father, would go to the coast to find work and then come home here once he gets some income. If you didn't reside in the housing given, if you went back to Barangay 88, the government would take back the house. So people had to split up their families. For example, mom would stay here, but dad would have to go there to the coast to find livelihood. So you have to split your income and have different budgets. That's what most of us here are struggling with.
That last bit about some families splitting up to balance the necessity of obtaining livelihood on the coast while maintaining proof of occupancy in their resettlement housing reinforces the perceived lack of livelihood opportunities in the inland resettlement areas.
I am sad because we are now commemorating the 10th year, but people have not really understood the term vulnerability. The kind of financial assistance coming from the government has not changed. Even policies of the government have not changed. So if government will not provide them the needed livelihood assistance, income-generating assistance, it will become another slum area in Tacloban North. If people remain vulnerable, then the impact of Haiyan or similar typhoon would still be the same.
That's Laydilyn Mangada, political scientist at the University of the Philippines, Tacloban College. She told us that access to livelihood remains a pertinent concern for coastal settlers relocated to the north. Her colleague, Ella Atienza, echoes this point.
it's not enough to just build houses or move people to safer ground. You also have to make sure that people have access to services, they can work. One of the complaints is that it's difficult to find work in those areas.
Ella is a political scientist in UP Diliman in Quezon City. She wrote the book, Urban Poverty in the Wake of Environmental Disaster, Rehabilitation, Resilience, and Typhoon Haiyan, Yolanda, with co-authors Pauline Edie and Maytan Mullins. The book chronicles their research on post-Yolanda reconstruction in Tacloban, Palo, and Tanawan from 2015 to 2018. The book also brings into focus how poverty is a main driver of vulnerability to disasters.
Definitely, the urban poor are more vulnerable to the impacts of disasters because their houses, their makeshift houses, are not strong enough to withstand disasters. At the same time, also, the only places where they can set up their houses are areas where it's very dangerous. They're the first to be hit by any storm surge and floods. They're also vulnerable because their incomes are the first ones to go after a disaster.
Asked about the question of livelihood in resettlement areas, Brando Bernadas told us that the city government provides people with options.
We provided them an option. We trained them for another livelihood. In fact, the city government has a progressive and continuing program, the Community Livelihood Entrepreneurial Program. For anybody along the coastal area, if they want to shift their way of living from being fisher folks to carpentry, to cooking, hairstyling, there are opportunities.
Meanwhile, the two political scientists noted that based on their research, some livelihood projects in the resettlement areas were not responsive to people's skills and preferences.
Well, some said that there were more options in terms of livelihood, but others say that some of the livelihood opportunities were not, in a way, applicable for certain sectors and certain areas. One example in relocation sites is that the Department of Trade and Industry has ready package of livelihood support for households. Like, for instance, they provide a package of meat that households can cook and sell. But, of course, you cannot cook everything in one afternoon. You need a refrigerator to store the leftovers. But there was no electricity in that area. So for many of these households, the tendency was they cooked everything so that they will not spoil. And the full family ate the food. So the purpose was defeated. So these are the examples of projects that did not take into account the appropriateness and the conditions available in the place that will receive the livelihood assistance.
Politics played an important role in shaping the trajectory of people's recovery. Much has been said about the political rivalry between the families of then-President Noynoy Aquino and Tacloban's mayor, Alfred Romualdez. Brando Bernadas attributed bottlenecks in the recovery process to the Aquino administration. He is hopeful that the familial ties between Mayor Romualdez and the current president, Bongbong Marcos, can streamline the recovery.
We really cannot meet some of our plans for rehabilitation recovery because of non-permission coming from the national government. We are still in problem of water supply, electric power, livelihood. At least the transportation, we were able to provide already transportation. But many of the basic needs are not yet fully implemented in all of our resettlement sites. In fairness, at least by now, the national administration is not anymore indifferent to Tacloban City because the mayor and the president are relatives. So at least there is a working partnership.
On the other end of political influence, Ella Atienza told us that the urban poor are vulnerable to exploitation by some politicians who capitalize on disasters to reinforce dependence on existing patron-client relations.
Many areas in the Philippines, including in Eastern Visayas, can be characterized as the political and social culture can be described as having this patron-clientelistic relationship. So many of them are used to living or surviving because of the dole-outs or support from local politicians and patrons who provide money, immediate relief in exchange for political support. They're the most vulnerable to exploitation by politicians who can use the distribution of aid, even the distribution of houses as a form of patronage.
Her research and those of others have documented instances when politicians prioritize their allies or supporters in the distribution of relief while sanctioning their critics by leaving them out of beneficiary lists. Part 3. Raffled lots, ruffled communities. How are people selected and informed about their status in resettlement projects?
Oh my God. So, based on my research, there are conflicting views. You have to take the two views. One, how the selection was done in a government-sponsored housing, and how the selection process was done in a non-government housing unit. For the NHA, the government-sponsored housing units, they say it should be a collaboration between the National Housing Authority and the local government unit of Tacloban. So, what happened is they did not agree. It was full of tension. In one housing unit, they would say that it's the NHA. The others, it's Tacloban. Nobody was saying that this is the result of deliberation between the two offices. On the ground, the people would say they were just informed that they will be transferred, but they do not know when. The story is quite different if it is a non-government. For instance, this Pope Francis housing units, the one in Diite, they would know. They know where. They know when. They know the problems. They were involved actually. People were informed.
Ted Jobson from the City Housing Office told us that local village officials created a list of families selected for relocation, which was then validated by an interagency committee from the city government and NGOs. The process became contentious as the National Housing Authority decided to award the houses by raffle draw, creating new communities where neighbors did not know one another.
You were not the one who raffled, who awarded the houses. It was the National Housing Authority. But if you're going to ask me, one resettlement should have been one barangay. For every relocation site, one barangay, and then the neighborhood, they know each other. But the National Housing Authority scrambled everything from one relocation site, different barangays. So it's very hard for the beneficiaries to adjust to the environment. You have to adjust to the people that's going to be your neighbor, to the environment, everything.
Knowing your neighbors and being able to seek help from them is a form of social capital. For the urban poor who lack financial capital, this social capital is often a lifeline.
Social capital is very important because that's their first network during the first impact of the disaster. Migrant families have more difficulty developing social capital because they're not familiar with their neighbors, particularly if they haven't lived in that area long, compared to areas where you have people who have lived in a particular area for a long time. They know one another. Some of them may be relatives. Of course, Filipinos always take pride of the practice or the value of bayanihan, the idea of helping one another. When you see your neighbor dealing with a problem that you can help, the whole community can provide assistance. Some areas where people do not know each other, it takes a long time for them to really build trust among themselves.
This social capital from a sense of community was disrupted by the resettlement of communities to Tacloban North, particularly in areas where lots were randomly distributed to families from different barangays. One location that managed to accommodate new residents all hailing from the same coastal barangay is the GMA Capuso Village. It was actually one of the earliest permanent housing projects to be completed, with the first houses turned over in 2014. Algina Lacaba and her family, as well as their neighbors in Barangay 88, were all resettled to new homes painted with the signature blue color of the GMA Capuso Foundation.
Yung isa sa pinaka ano na sinasabi kong swerte kasi nga,
we were really lucky because those who were our neighbors before also became our neighbors here. We were all from the same barangay. There wasn't too much adjustment because you already knew them. There are some here who didn't live close to our house, but their faces are familiar. So far, I'd say it's peaceful. A little noise is normal, some karaoke, that's sometimes not at the appropriate time, but nothing too abusive. Because we were all neighbors before. From block 1 to block 21 here, almost everyone knew each other. If not the name, then at least the faces were familiar. That's for the GMA Capuso Village housing. Other housing projects, people from different coastal barangays were mixed together.
Coastal areas na Tacloban sila.
A common practice implemented in NGO-sponsored housing projects to cultivate a sense of community among their beneficiaries was the so-called sweat equity. This refers to the practice of beneficiaries contributing hours of labor to the construction of their new houses. In addition to building community with your future neighbors, sweat equity also instilled a sense of pride and dignity among homeowners that these houses were not simply dole-outs.
So, tong bahay nito, hindi siya totally na...
This house, it's not a dole-out. It's not provided, and then you just move in. You need to have sweat equity, 500 hours. One family member would have to help constructing this. There was some struggle to complete those 500 hours of sweat equity. Like, in our case, my husband had to work. So at that time, I really had to be the one to come here and help in the construction. It wasn't too difficult, things like mixing the sand. And then you'd also be building your relationship with your neighbors. Your ties were becoming stronger because everyone was together making their future homes.
Sama-sama kayong gumagawa ng bahay.
Part 4. Unfulfilled promises and compounding vulnerabilities. Many of the researchers we spoke to identified Pope Francis Village as a model of best practices for resettlement projects in Tacloban. Pope Francis Village, or PFV, is composed of 566 units with residents coming from 17 coastal barangays. It is located in Barangay Diit, about 6 kilometers from downtown, and much closer than the resettlement sites in Tacloban North. PFV was anchored on a quote-unquote people-driven approach, which is rooted in participatory practices and community organizing. One of the main proponents of the project was a Manila-based NGO called the Urban Poor Associates, or UPA. It was founded by the late Dennis Murphy, who is sometimes referred to as the father of community organizing in the Philippines. Following the people-driven approach, high-end survivors were involved throughout the development of PFV. Project beneficiaries provided sweat equity in the early phases, although later their involvement was limited to monitoring in order to speed up construction progress and lower costs. Beneficiary selection was deliberative. They would draw lots publicly, and others present could contest the outcomes. Of course, not everyone in the 17 barangays involved would be selected for the 566 units in PFV, but this participatory process helped ease potential tensions in the relocation. Even the naming of the project was participatory.
It was the beneficiary themselves who want to call the village Pope Francis Village. In honor of Pope Francis, honor of his visit, the community was named after Pope Francis. At the same time, as a representation of the values espoused by the Pope himself, that the community will be God-fearing, resilient, spiritually inclined. That's the origin.
That's Ida Vidal. Ida moved to Tacloban when she was brought on as the general manager of Francesco, the consortium managing the Pope Francis Village project. This consortium is composed of the Urban Poor Associates and its partner organizations and funders. Meanwhile, the project beneficiaries, that is, the resettled typhoon survivors, are organized into a homeowners association, or HOA. It was in our conversations with Francesco and the HOA that we found frustrations brewing in this model community.
We would have been happier here if the livelihood projects and equipment that were given to us back then weren't taken away. We had hollow blocks making. That was very good livelihood. We had plans to form a cooperative, but we lost that. Then the urban gardening. We had facilities for that. They all vanished.
That's Estrella Ambid. She is the current president of the Homeowners Association. She is frustrated that the livelihood projects that they once had at Pope Francis Village had vanished. She felt that the people who said they would help them were breaking their promises.
We were all shocked. Why did that happen? Turns out, they were being taken away slowly. The people in charge would ask us, "Did you sign anything to prove that all those were yours?" We did not sign anything, but we know that those are supposed to be ours. We fully trusted them because they said they would help us.
Here's what we understand. Equipment and spaces for livelihood projects such as hollow blocks making, construction, and urban gardening were sold off in order to raise funds for the project. Francesco told us that this was necessary because one major funder backed out. They said they then had no choice but to take out loans to finish construction of all houses at the Pope Francis Village. After construction finished in 2021, they needed to sacrifice some assets in order to partially settle these loans and start issuing titles for the homeowners.
Right now, one of the biggest challenges the Pope Francis Village is how to settle the payables and outstanding obligation to suppliers and partners. So that's why we're still here, even though we already finished the construction of housing units in 2020 and the site development in 2021. Because we cannot proceed with the land titling unless we settle our obligation. So we really need to settle, because one of the reason why UPA was involved in the project is to ensure land tenure security for the beneficiaries. So the land title is the concrete manifestation of ensuring land tenure security for them. And there are bottlenecks that we need to solve before we can proceed with the titling.
Factions are forming within the community leadership and within the community at large. One camp is frustrated at these outcomes, and another is more understanding of the necessity for these decisions. Philip Lumbre, the previous HOA president, belongs to the latter camp.
I don't blame Francesco or UPA for their decisions. This is why we are being divided into two factions here. For us, we understand Francesco. We understand UPA. Because there was no other way. If the funder didn't back out, do you think we'd have this problem? Do you think we'd get a loan? No. Do you think they'd need to sell the trucks and heavy equipment? Yes. We're also sad about the hollow blocks making livelihood that we had here. But what's to be done?
Philip says he accepts what happened with the Pope Francis Village livelihood projects, because the bottom line is that they have resilient houses to keep their families safe from hazards.
I don't call this just a house. It's a home. All I can say is to UPA, Francesco, all those who helped us, we owe you a debt of gratitude. I don't know about others, if they can accept that truth. For me,
pero as ex-president of the homeowners of the association ng PFB, I am proud to say that they come to our life and we take them.
I will be thankful for the rest of my life.
Ida says one lesson she learned from this experience is to make sure that all funding is fully secured before embarking on such an ambitious project. She also said she's learned to be more clear-eyed about the complications of implementing people-driven approaches in reality.
The people-driven approach should be used appropriately and with adjustments and refinements along the way. It should not be a fixed formula that you have to do from step 1 to step 10. You should adapt to the changing environment. And also, for me, it should be important and imperative that funds are intact before embarking on a big project like the Pope Francis Village. Because what happened was the consortium decided to start the project when funding is still insufficient to complete the housing units.
Ida also told us she felt a bit regretful that the project only benefited 566 families despite its high costs.
Can you imagine, we spent almost $500 million and only 56 families benefited. And you can imagine how many families that were affected by Yolanda that were not able to benefit from this project.
$500 million, or about $9 million, to resettle 566 families displaced by Haiyan. Ida said she hopes Francesco can settle its obligations and complete the turnover of land titles to the Pope Francis Village homeowners in 1 to 2 years. Another problem we heard about in the resettlement sites was the issue of access to clean water. Piped water is available, but this is not potable. The consequence is that households need to buy bottles of drinking water, a significant additional expense for low-income households. When the taps run dry, as they happen periodically, people might resort to using that bottled drinking water for other domestic needs, such as sanitation.
Patubig talaga dito sa Tacloban.
Access to water here at Tacloban is really a challenge, even here. Our water here is intermittent. Sometimes we have no water for hours. One year when we had an anniversary, there was no water for several weeks. I'm always trying to lobby with a water utility.
Please, water is human right.
I asked Estrella if the tap water is what they use for drinking.
Hindi. Hindi, kasi sa totoo lang, hindi siya
no. The truth is, the tap water really isn't clean. When you clean your bucket after 2 days, it seems oily. It's not clean. Well, sometimes it looks clean, but we don't really drink that or use it for cooking. We use mineral water, as if we're rich here. We only use the tap water for bathing, doing laundry, hygiene, and sanitation. The water utility also sells mineral water, and that's what we buy. 25 pesos per refill. Houses here, we have multiple large gallon containers for mineral water. I have 8, just for drinking. But sometimes, when there's no water on the tap, we use mineral water to bathe. As if we're rich.
Pinapaligo namin yun. Mayayaman eh. Mayayaman.
Over at the GMA Capuso Village in Tacloban North, Algina Lacaba painted a similar picture.
The water is still a problem because it's not potable, not for drinking. We have to buy mineral water for drinking and cooking. Here we have more bills because we have to pay for water and buy drinking water. The tap water is just for cleaning, washing clothes, and bathing. But at least there's access to that.
Mayroon access.
Lack of reliable access to running water was particularly problematic during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, when frequent hand washing was advised. Laidlin Mangada documented a number of challenges experienced in the resettlement sites during the pandemic.
When somebody was sick in the family, they could not bring it to the hospital because it was also far. And so they made use of the herbs, the leaves that use the traditional way of healing. Since school was no longer face-to-face, what happened to the students? Especially the young people, they were gallivanting around. The barangay captain mentioned about the rise of local TEF initiated by the young people. Because they have nothing to do. They were not in school, so they were just in the community.
Several interviewees also told us about what they referred to as youth riots in the resettlement sites. Estrella Ambid told us that she had to request for 24/7 police presence around Pope Francis Village to stop the youth violence there.
Youth riots occurred here because it was very dark at night. This is where they would fight. So that's why we requested for police to guard us 24/7. 6 of them during daytime and 6 at night. Actually, Pope Francis Village was only the venue. Those youth are not from here. They come from other nearby barangays. Only 1 or 2 young people from here got involved at some point, but we stopped them. We found out that they were using social media to tell people to come to PFV to riot. Now it stopped because of the police. But it was scary back then. At night, those kids would throw stones or shoot people with improvised sumpak guns. It was those sumpak toy guns that really scared us.
Doon kami natakot sa mga sumpak.
In terms of physical hazards, Tacloban North apparently still faces various kinds, despite the initial site assessments conducted. Here's Laidlin Mangada, followed by Algina Lacaba.
If you go there, especially during rainy season, the streets in Tacloban North, they're also flooded. See, that's one of the problems they have there now. Flooded streets, roads, when this season, the wet season, sets in.
Marami nang malalakas na lindol. Minsan din
there have been a number of earthquakes. Sometimes, we don't feel the earthquake. Of all the housing projects, I'm proud to say that this is the strongest housing given by NGOs.
Both Estrella Ambid and Algina Lacaba expressed that despite some challenges, they were still lucky. People who ended up in the government-sponsored projects had greater difficulties to face. In those places, houses were of lower quality. Mayor Romualdez even called the units provided by the National Housing Authority, quote-unquote, substandard, in a 2022 interview with ABS-CBN News. Some relocation sites are not yet connected to basic utilities like electricity and water. Across all provinces affected by Yolanda, 15% of the NHA housing units for survivors were still unfinished as of September 2023, according to reporting from Rappler's Pia Ranada. Thousands of completed units were unoccupied due to the various reasons we talked about. Evidently, when it comes to resettlement, those led by non-government organizations were more successful in coming close to the vision laid out at the beginning of this episode. Next episode, we'll hear more perspectives about and from NGOs involved in the post-Haiyan recovery effort.
Some of the aid agencies and the NGOs that we interviewed, some of their representatives have admitted and pointed out their own contributions to the perpetuation of the patron-clientelistic relationship, as well as, of course, many of them have started becoming self-aware in the sense that when you have too many foreigners, particularly white people, in certain areas, you also create the idea of the global north as being the dominant one. So you replicate the power relationship.
Carried by Water is a production of Blue Lab at Princeton University. This episode was produced by me, Mario Soriano, along with Patrick Alhoco and Braden Carroll. This episode was mixed by Braden Carroll. Our sincerest gratitude to Madame Alicia Gentolia Murphy, coordinator of the Urban Poor Associates, as well as the other members of UPA, the Francesco Consortium, and the Pope Francis Village Homeowners Association for sharing their stories with us. A big thank you to Sir Emoy Rodolfo of the Ateneo de Manila University for introducing us to UPA. Thank you to our friends at the Princeton Filipino Community Undergraduate Club,
Mackie Flauta,
Cassie Ng,
Joshua Soberano,
Alan Yeva,
and
Isa Cebedo
for providing voiceovers for this episode. For their support and expertise, we also thank the High Meadows Environmental Institute, the Princeton Humanities Council, the Office of the Dean of Research, as well as Covenda Media. Allison Carruth is the Director of Blue Lab, and Baron Bixler is the Creative Director. Visit our website, bluelab.princeton.edu, for more information and photographs for this episode. Until next time.